is the Grinlian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grinlian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
And from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grinlian Bunker, welcome again, my friends. It is the Grinlian Report. I am the mouth of the South, Micah Hanks, joined in studio with Caleb Hanks and Tyler Pittman. Both of you, gentlemen, friends, colleagues, countrymen, how are we this evening?
I'm just wonderful, Micah.
As am I.
Well, I'm glad to have you both here with me, and all of you, my dear listeners out there in Gradioland, joining us yet again. You've made this your weekly one-stop shop for the strange and the unusual, broadcasting live from the dark heart of the Mohorovic discontinuity somewhere between the realms of the Darrows, the Taros, and the Hadals. And this week, I tell you, we've got quite a show lined up for you. Is the U.S. Navy watching UFO websites like the Grinlian Report? And what about Supreme Courts saying that it's okay for the police basically to gather your DNA during a traffic stop? We're also going to be examining a little bit of off-the-cuff history here in the United States. Harry Hubbard will be our guest during Hour 2, discussing the mystery caves of Illinois. And he happens to be quite an expert on UFO phenomenon as well. I'll be getting into that with him just a little bit as well. But right off the bat, I have to say, I went on a very fantastic and fun program last night. The Kevin Moore Show, broadcast out of the UK. It's both televised via satellite as well as a broadcast radio program. And so I was able to sit here in the comfort, well, the slightly moist and dank comfort of the bunker, and do that program live. It's just amazing where technology's going. And so immediately afterward, I stepped out and I was, a number of minutes before I made it back to the surface because the elevator's taking longer and longer these days. I don't know. I'm hoping there aren't Hadals chewing those cables because if that were the case, guys, we may be stuck down here for a while. But I finally made my way outside. I called Caleb, and I was engaging in a bit of star watching last night. And as I'm out there watching the stars, I mean, it was just a great night. I was seeing meteorites. I was seeing, gosh, you know, everything. And there were a lot of commercial satellites, what appeared to be, you know, just little blips that would come up and appear here and there. And so I called Caleb on the phone, and I was telling him about this. At one point, I saw something that was really unique. It was a little very faint white light, and it was drifting along, and it would disappear, and then it would flash very faintly, but I would see the flash, and then it would disappear again. And I watched this little guy tumble along like that, and I thought, you know, obviously what I'm seeing here is some sort of a little piece of metallic debris, and it's turning as it's you know, coursing along through space, and as it turns and tumbles, it's catching light and it's reflecting light back, and it gave the impression of this little glowing, pulsing light. You know, I mean, in extremely high altitude, in actual orbital space. Well, anyway, I'm out there, and I was, while discussing all this with Caleb, you know, I'd see something here or there, and I'd excitedly mention what I'd seen. Oh, there went another meteor. And at one point, this incredibly bright white light, I mean, as bright as the moon, just not as large, this thing comes drifting overhead. Now, I hear what I perceive to be a jet engine. I'm looking at this object, and I'm going, am I really seeing what I'm seeing? Is this really happening? I'm watching this object. It drifts overhead. It follows on a northeasterly course. I had my compass on my phone out, and I started taking pictures of it. The pictures didn't turn out really well, but I was so excited, and I told Caleb, I said, I think I just, for the first time, I mean, really, without question, saw a UFO. I mean, this was just incredible. It was, the very brightest light I've ever seen in the sky, ever. And again, there was this little whirring jet noise, and I thought, so this has got to be some sort of like an aircraft, but there were no flashing lights. There were no secondary or colored lights. It was just a bright white light, and it drifted directly overhead. And I watched it, and I continued to watch it for about 4 minutes until it disappeared over the horizon. Now, I have to say, I was incredibly perplexed at what I'd seen. Guys, I mean, what would you all think if you were standing out in a field and you're observing the night sky, and all of a sudden, an inexplicable, I mean, like the brightest star, brighter than Sirius. I mean, this thing is just, it's moving through the sky. What do you think when you see that, you know?
I know exactly what that was.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it was Red Pill Junkie and his biplane.
You mean his bi-drone, right?
Yeah, it's his bi-drone.
His bi-drone. Tyler, I mean, I remember you and I were outside one evening after the show, and we saw an iridium flare. And I remember I asked you a question about it, because at the time, I mean, it does look anomalous, and I wanted to get a feel for what you thought. And I remember you saying, man, it's just something strange is going on tonight. But, I mean, imagine seeing a bright white light drift directly overhead like that. I mean, what would your... I just... Try and imagine what your reaction would be. How would you react to something like that?
Probably similarly to what the Heaven's Gate cult did.
Yeah, that's
right. It's hard to say without you know, having the same image you had in my head.
Right. Yeah, it would obviously help to be there. Well, now, someone out there in Gradioland, someplace, is probably listening and going, oh, come on, Micah, really? Because there is a conventional explanation for what I saw, and that's the reason I bring this up, is because to be serious about our serious research in UFOs, not serious like Stephen Greer serious, I'm talking serious, okay? If we're going to be serious, we have to be able to rule out all the, what would you call them, false positives? You know, the seemingly inexplicable that actually is quite explicable. When I first observed this bright light going directly over my head, I thought, there's no explanation other than some sort of an aircraft. But I think the listeners have heard this on this program a few times. And, of course, our friends who listen to Mysterious Universe no doubt heard me talking about this on their program. I've got a little app on my iPhone called Sputnik with an exclamation point. Now, Sputnik, of course, is the name of the first Soviet satellite that went into orbit. And this, as the name entails, this app allows you to track the course of two different kinds of objects in orbit. Iridium satellites, which produce bright flares when they direct sunlight back at Earth, which gives them the impression of being some sort of an object that's just traveling along, and then at a specific time they just get brighter, 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 and then they blast you with light, and then they get diminished, and then they often will disappear. Tyler and I witnessed one of these together one evening after the program. But they'll also help you chart the course of the International Space Station. Well, I had gone out to see if there were going to be any iridium flares last night. And so when I stepped out, the first thing I looked at was at Sputnik to see if indeed there were going to be any iridium flares. There weren't any. But there were two instances within about an hour and a half of one another when the International Space Station would appear. One was at 10:20, one was at about 11:49 p.m. Eastern Time. Now, what I saw, I knew, had taken place minutes after 10:20, and I thought, surely that couldn't have been the space station. This was too big. This was too bright. Well, sure enough, looking at Sputnik, the data, it gives you so much data. This app, to be a free app, is incredible. Part of the data that they gave us, okay, via the Sputnik app, actually said that the ISS not only would be traveling along a northeasterly course, but you would see it begin to appear over the horizon from the south, or I guess from the southwest, at 10:20, but it would peak in the sky at 10:24 and disappear over the far horizon, traveling northeast at approximately 10:27, which perfectly matched the timing of the object that had passed overhead. And so I decided, well, it's going to show up again at 11:49, so I'll stick around and I'll see what happens. And sure enough, it wasn't as brilliant or as bright, and it was a little bit further off away from the horizon, but the second time, sure enough, there it was again. I was amazed at how convinced I was about this. And Caleb, I called you and I said, man, I have seen a UFO.
I was amazed at how convinced you were, too.
Yeah, and that's the whole thing. It's just, you know, it takes a lot to get me excited, but I'm not going to just let it rest and say, okay, I've seen a UFO. And this is what's incredible. When you have something incredible happen and yet you're able to dig into data that you are able to access via computer, or better yet, through a little portable, again, you can hardly call them cell phones. An iPhone is like a portable multi-function device. You know, that's what I like to call these things, because they do so much more than just allow you to make phone calls. They're like little computers that happen to have a phone built into them.
They're your little buddy.
Yeah. You know, one day they're going to have artificial intelligence. You know, hey, Jarvis, hey, it's Micah. Find this for me. But it's incredible, because I was able to determine what I'd seen, and yet it was probably one of the most incredible things I've ever seen in my life. And even knowing it was just the International Space Station, I had just never caught it at a moment where the ISS was so bright. And the reason it was so bright is because this was right after 10:20 p.m. Eastern Time. And so at that altitude, it was perfectly reflecting, and very brilliantly, sunlight okay, from off to the west. And so it was just incredible. It was the brightest object in the sky, brighter than the moon, but much smaller. So you'd be able to tell the difference. But, I mean, it was just incredible. And to think that we were able to do this sort of thing. I remember Aaron Wright from Mysterious Universe, right after I'd gone on their show and talked about the Sputnik app, he had said, "I just saw my first iridium flare." And I can't tell you how incredible this is to have access to this kind of technology and to be able to get out there on a nightly basis and have this experience where you see incredible things in the sky and you can know preemptively when they're going to show up and when you can plan to go see them. And then I think about all the people out there who have that experience just by, you know, happenstance. They just happen to be out in a field looking at the sky and they happen to see something that they can't explain and they don't know where to begin to look for information that would help them determine what it was. And so what is that left to their mind? It's a UFO. And the National UFO Reporting Center or other agencies, Bigelow Airspace, you know, they get these stories from people who are maybe very credible, intelligent, and informed witnesses, but maybe don't have all the tools and the applications. And so this is really becoming one of my new goals as a UFO researcher. I really hope to be able to educate people on how they can rule out scientifically based on evidence that's available. If you have a phone, iPhones aren't free, but if you have an iPhone, the app is free. And so it's inexpensive technology that you can have access to in your pocket that helps you scientifically determine what you're looking at.
Also, I wanted to throw out, if people didn't hear last week's show, we had Mark D'Antonio on, and he actually mentioned another app that isn't free, but it's really, really good, called GetSatWatch that right. he uses, which is apparently like really in-depth and shows you like everything. So this is another tool that you can utilize to kind of wean out some of these things that you might otherwise not know.
And of course, that's just a one-time fee. So really, I mean, what is it? That one's like 10 or 15?
I think it's like $10, but... It's $10. You pretty much spend that on like a meal
you
somewhere.
You spend $10 one time and you're able to watch the skies for as long as you have that phone. And I tell you, it's just incredible. It's going to change. I couldn't help but think about this. I used to pick on this guy a lot on the program. His name's Ed Grimsley. I've met Ed Grimsley on... Caleb, I think you've met him too. Did you meet him when he came to Asheville?
I'm not sure.
You weren't missing much. Ed Grimsley, I met him once in Asheville, and he mortally offended me. He was an absolute just, he's a little goblin or something. And then Grimsley, I ran into him again out there in Sacramento last summer. And here it was 2 o'clock in the morning. And Anthony Sanchez, Rita Louise, David Weatherly, and Ed Grimsley and I are hanging out in a hotel room drinking Corona. And I said I had a headache, and Grimsley goes, "Here, I'll show you how to get rid of that." And he comes over and he takes my hands.
Does he do the Vulcan death pinch?
Yes, but Grimsley's got these long fingernails, and he just dug his fingernails into my hand. I literally had a scab on my hand for like a month after Grimsley did that, and I'm just like, I didn't ask you to do that, Grimsley. But anyway, I could tell you Ed Grimsley stories all night. But the reason I bring Ed Grimsley up is, the Grimes Master, I mean, the Grimsley, he takes people out with I guess, third generation, fourth generation night vision goggles and the like. And he points up at the sky and points at stuff and says, "You can see UFOs getting in dogfights. I first witnessed them when I was a child. I would watch them. There were little UFOs up there fighting, and you could see them every night." And I'm thinking about all the commercial satellites. I'm thinking about all the space junk, all the debris, all the things over the years that Grimsley has claimed to see and thought that he was actually seeing a dogfight or something along those lines. I think about all the little objects that are floating around up there in space that guys like Ed Grimsley think are actual alien visitors. And then I think about being able to step out on a clear night and literally be treated to a nighttime light show and being able to know what I'm seeing. I think it's important to educate just as well as to go looking for the unconventional. This is Mike Hanks. It's the Graylian Report. We'll be back right after this. And welcome back to the program. It is the Grayling Report, keeping you company each Tuesday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. We're about to be joined by a friend of the program. I believe he's been on fairly recently. We'll have to have him on again sometime in the near future. But while we have him tonight, I want to introduce to those of you who are unfamiliar with him and his work, Ryan Sprague, who has come to tell us about a new project that he'll be working on here over the next few weeks.
Thank you so much, Micah. Thanks for having me, man.
It's always my pleasure. And then second of all, I want to say I have caught wind that you have a new Kickstarter project that you are doing. And so I wanted to give you an opportunity to tell us about that because, of course, we support the arts here on the Grayling Report. And so without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to you. Tell us about this new project, what you're aiming to do, and how you hope to get there.
Sure. Thanks so much, Mike. I appreciate that. I'm working on a feature film right now. You know, when I'm not writing about the paranormal, I'm writing scripts left and right, plays, movies, and currently I have one of my plays being adapted into a feature film. I was approached about a year ago to consult and adapt the script, and we're ready to go, man. We start filming in September. We've booked our actors. We've locked our locations. But you know that one crucial thing that we always lack is the funds.
that's just the bane of the artist's existence. What's the film going to be? What is the film going to be about, Ryan?
The film is about a woman dealing with the aftermath of a natural disaster. Something pretty relevant right now with. The horrible tragedies happening in Oklahoma. This particular story takes place in New Orleans a year after Hurricane Katrina, and it's actually based on a woman I met in New Orleans literally a year after. Met her at a bus stop. We started talking, and she told me how she had tragically lost her brother during a flooding accident, and I sort of it sort of stayed in my mind after that, and I decided to write a play about it, Micah. Wow. The play itself has had about four productions here in New York and around the East Coast, and then I was approached by a film company who was interested in making it into a movie. And it's really a story about struggling to find hope through something that's so tragic and moving on and finding family and friends and people you may not have once thought could be, but it can take tragedy to bring people together.
I absolutely believe that, however unfortunate it is, and I don't think that people have to go through heartbreaking tragedy in order to find one another and the bonds that we naturally have, but that is probably the most positive aspect of the ongoing nature of life in general, which is that tragedy will happen, and the only thing perhaps that is redeeming is that it brings people together. You know, this is incredibly inspiring, and it sounds like such a fantastic story. Now, you've launched a Kickstarter to be able to help fund parts of this project. Am I correct?
That's correct, Micah. Yeah, we put the campaign up about 5 days ago, maybe, and it's been going good so far, getting some very generous people here and there. A lot in the paranormal community are really helping to share the Kickstarter and supporting me any way they can, which is amazing. You know, this story has absolutely nothing to do with UFOs, which is sort of a departure for me, but it's a very human story, and I'm so thrilled that the opportunity has arisen, and we're just trying to get the word out about it, Micah. Anything anyone can do to help, you know, whether it's share the Kickstarter page or give a few bucks here and there, we've got some amazing incentives for you. With every donation, you're already getting a copy of the completed movie. We've got some awesome incentives. The higher you decide to contribute, and we're just really excited to get the word out and make this movie. It's a dream come true for me to widen that audience. You know, it was great to have the play, but to be able to share it with a wider audience is something I never expected, and we just want to make it a reality, man.
I hope that we will, and with the support of listeners like the folks out there in Gradio Land, we will certainly do that. You'll find the Kickstarter for Ryan Sprague's latest project linked up in the show notes at graylianreport.com. Ryan, do you know the address right offhand as well, just so that people who are just listening live this evening, they might also be able to go and take a look at it?
Of course, yeah. It's kind of have a long link, but what I can give you, Micah, is the Facebook page for the movie itself.
Sure.
And we'll have the link right directly linked to that. It's facebook.com/Reverie Lane. That's R-E-V-E-R-I-E-L-A-N-E. And that's just facebook.com/Reverie Lane.
Perfect. All right. Fantastic. And I hope that people will take a look at that. You know, again, as you'd mentioned, this is a departure somewhat for you, because I know that one of your previous plays, which I happen to own the 100% cotton t-shirt for, which you gave me at the International UFO Congress. Yes, you did a play on Rendlesham, the famous UFO incident. You know, for folks who are unfamiliar with that, tell us a bit about that play.
Sure. Yeah. Still in the process as we speak, Micah. Almost done with the completed script for that. Rendlesham, 1980, happened over in Suffolk, England. Very famous case over there. Not so much here in the States, but what I'm trying to do is get the word out about that case. You know, it's developing every day. And my story, my play itself, follows one of the witnesses of the case, Mr. Larry Warren, and our mutual friend, Mr. Peter Robbins. They co-wrote a British best-selling book about the incident, and I sort of chronicle the journey of these two men in writing their book about the incident. And it's got everything you could ask for. It's got drama, it's got comedy, it's got a little bit of sci-fi, and it's got UFOs. And what more can you ask for?
What more can you ask for? I want to see that play. You know, I hope to be able to make it up when this actually premieres. I presume that will premiere in New York, right?
I'm already developing it with a few theater companies here, Micah. Very excited about that. And I actually got news yesterday that a film company is going to be doing a short film about the play. Just signed the contracts for that yesterday. Very pumped about that. We're going to be shooting it on a Red camera, which I don't know if you're familiar with that at all. It's a beautiful, beautiful camera. And we're going to be shooting that up here in Long Island here in New York. And very excited about that. We've got some amazing talent attached to that. And we're going to be shooting in October. Hopefully get it up and get people more excited about the full-length play that's to come in hopefully 2014. Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed indeed. You know, I hope to be able to make it up there for a debut of this play, because not only am I fascinated with it, but, you know, some of the key players are friends of mine. You mentioned Peter Robbins, and of course Peter is just a dear friend, a mutual friend of both of us, and frankly I think he would be called a friend to the UFO community. He's just a great guy, isn't he?
All around, Micah, one of the best guys you could ask for in the field. And to have you there, have Peter there, have Larry there, all the top dogs in the field, I would be completely honored. You all get free tickets. You got a place to stay. And yeah, all I can ask for is the fans of the Grailian Report to support that, support our Kickstarter. And I couldn't be more honored to be a part of the family here at the Grailian Report. And let's do it, man. Let's make some art.
Let's make some art indeed. You know, so I've said in the past on this program, Ryan, that art is important, especially to our line of work, because it promotes abstract thinking, especially among young students. And something that I've often said, you know, Scotty Roberts, my partner with Intrepid Magazine and Paradigm Symposium, he is a professional artist, and for years he worked as an art director. Mike Cleland, who actually visited the bunker the other day, we did a long session on abduction experience he had had throughout his life. Mike also had worked as an art director and a layout director. And in fact, this is a little lesser known aspect, but although my brother's best known in this studio as being the artist at hand with his Gray Street comic that he's been doing for the Grailian Report Online, I took just about every elective course for art that you could when I was in high school. And for a long time, I actually wanted to be an illustrator just as well. And I was pretty good. I was always interested in comic art, but also I did a lot of still life and primarily just pencil drawings and things like that, but never really got into the realm of painting. And what I've always recognized about this is that art is indeed something that promotes abstract thinking. It helps you think a little bit more. I don't know how you'd put it, but I guess you can take into account all the seemingly unrelated aspects of reality, because I think that the artist mind looks to try and represent what we see every day you know, take that and make something fantastic and a little more colorful out of that and commit it to the canvas. And so, you know, art is just, it's incredibly important. And I'm so glad that there are people like you who kind of bridge that gap between serious ufological research and the arts. So, you know, and I'll point this out just as well. When you evoke the masses of the Grey Lagoon Report listenership, you're probably going to have a good crowd, because our largest listenership anywhere, probably in the continental United States, is right there in the Big Apple. So we send our love out to the folks there in the Big Apple and ask them to help support Ryan Sprague with this endeavor. Ryan, anything else and any ways that folks can contact you directly?
Yeah, they're more than welcome to contact me over Facebook. I'm pretty easy to find on there. They can visit my website, ryandsprague.com. Other than that, Micah, I couldn't be happier to be here with you. I thank you for your time and for your listeners taking the time to hear me out. And like I said, man, you're one of the top guys out there, and I'm so happy to be friends with you and to share this art with you and everyone involved. So thanks, man.
Hearing you say that makes me feel like one of the top guys. All right, Ryan Sprague, ladies and gentlemen, columnist, writer for Open Minds magazine, and all-around great guy. Glad to have you on the program again, Ryan, and we'll have to keep in touch. Right before we went to air tonight, there was this story that was brought to my attention. I think... was it Red Pill Junkie that sent this to us, I believe? I think it was actually copied to the Grey Lagoon Report as well as to Mysterious Universe. And the story goes as follows. This was Anthony Bregaglia that was talking about this. Okay. At the UFO Iconoclasts website. The story goes, U.S. Navy caught monitoring UFO websites. And I've heard about this kind of thing happening before. I just have to say, we have Greg Bishop, you know, of course, of the UFO Mystic website. He and Nick Redfern were bloggers both for that site. And Nick's probably had some of this happen too, but I know that Greg had been one of the key players. After his book Project Aurora came out, he had kind of undergone an ongoing series of incidents that really kind of bred paranoia in his life. I think he'd said that his mail had been read and all different kinds of little strange things were happening that he had noticed. Well, anyway, when he began to really start getting most concerned, he said that he had at different times noticed that little pings would come in. You know, if you have a blog, for instance, you have most often some sort of statistics monitoring software that you can use to see where, in general terms, where some visits are coming from to your blog or your website. We use this at the Grey Lagoon Report just as well. And so he had said that he had seen what appeared to be visits coming from government servers, which I thought was kind of interesting. So Anthony Bregaglia here, writing for the UFO Iconoclasts, says a little known U.S. Navy agency employing some of the nation's top information technology experts has been selectively monitoring websites that carry articles that relate to UFO crashes, Roswell, and related events. Now, for at least 5 years, this small Navy organization has found, visited, and reviewed certain blogs, writers, and forums that discuss subjects including UFOs, and including this blog right here that we're reading this from, the UFO Iconoclasts.
Well, that's not unsettling, especially for us.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm not surprised in the least, but the thing is it goes on down to mention this agency. Bregaglia says, I have located several examples of Navy Network Information Center visits to online UFO articles and whose visitor logs are available for review. He goes on to mention UFOblogger.com had reported that on December 8th, 2010, their visitor tracking program indicated a visit by the NNIC. Again, this is the Navy Network Information Center. Mel Fabregas, friend of the program, he had said that Veritas Radio reported on January 29th that a UFO website author had contacted him to report that this had happened after posting an article called UFO Sighting Over President Barack Obama's Inauguration. Literally said that, this is incredible. Fabregas reported that he contacted this Italian researcher, Paola Harris, name that many in this field probably know, and Harris told him, I've gotten several emails citing intelligence groups who are logging on to UFO websites just as well. And even patently fake UFO alien encounter tales can apparently catch the interest of the NNIC. As far back as 5 years ago, the Open Minds forums, yet again, friends of ours, they had mentioned that among the first visitors to the SERPO site was the NNIC. So it's very interesting. Apparently, this agency, according to Bregaglia, has been looking into and watching UFO websites. He goes on, we'll have this linked in the show notes just as well, but he goes on to talk about a number of other instances where this is apparently ongoing. So are you a UFO researcher? Do you maintain a UFO website like the Grey Lagoon Report? And how often have you suspected that you perhaps were being observed or watched by somebody out there in officialdom? You know, we're working on a new project where we're hoping to be able to put out regular reports here at Graylian Report. And these reports...
Fancy that.
Yeah, hence the name. Hence the name.
Regular okay. Graylian Reports.
Yeah, but, you know, seriously, I'd like to... ideally, what I envision is trying to get out a quarterly journal of some sort, which may, rather than being... actually, I'd like to put out a journal that has a lot of different subjects that are discussed, which is very similar already to Intrepid Magazine. But, you know, ideally, I'd like to have something in-house where we have, you know, something that comes out quarterly, a lot of different things. But ideally, the Graylian Reports would be a focus on a single subject in essay form that is something that can be downloaded via ebook readers or that you could also just purchase as a print document if you wanted. If you're old school and you like reading a book, I kind of do. And this first edition that we're going to be getting out has to do with reports of, I think, typically in UFO literature, you'd call these ghost rockets, but... I think in the classical sense, that's probably the best name for these things. But I would kind of prefer calling them, in my own terms, anomalous missiles, because they really, in most instances, seem to kind of... that's what they appear to be. They're missiles. And rather than being rockets, intended for flying up into space, this was a popular term at the time that these ghost rockets first began to appear, especially in parts of Scandinavia at around 1946... with this modern age of intercontinental ballistic missiles and things like that, these are more accurately, rather are a more accurate description of what people who have these experiences claim they see. They are seen from aircraft, and we've talked about some of these incidents here on this program. A few episodes back, we had talked about people's experiences seeing missiles from aircraft. Pilots report these things. And there's an agency, or rather a reporting database that is monitored by NASA. They don't enforce regulation or anything like that. And if anything, they are conducive to anonymity so that they can gather information without people who are reporting safety concerns feeling that they are going to, basically fall into a position where they're going to have to testify or if there may be some sort of disciplinary action taken. It is the feeling of the Federal Aviation Administration, essentially, that if there is an organization like NASA without regulatory power that will monitor safety concerns that are reported anonymously by pilots and other people involved in aviation, that they can better assess the threat of potential dangers like, you know, and a lot of it's just basic stuff like black ice on a runway or electrical anomalies or things like that that could lead to problems later on. But if you dig into those reports, it's interesting because you will find mention time after time of what people describe as being missiles and projectiles and things like that, which is a very strange and, frankly, a very consistent anomaly that has been present for about the last half century in ufology, starting with those ghost rocket reports from back in the 40s. So I think it's very interesting that this is something that people always refer to as being a portion of the history of ufology and that it was occurring only after the war. Man, the reports of weird, out-of-place missiles just flying along through the sky and often without an exhaust trail, they have continued since the 1940s, and they are still seen today. So,
secret Nerf testing.
Yeah, I mean, who knows what these things are? But, and there's some compelling evidence that these things have been associated with crashes and wreckages. You know, I mean, just who knows what exactly is going on, but I think that it gets a little into the area of government cover-ups. It gets a little into the area of truly Fortean and unexplainable phenomenon. It gets a little into the area of clandestine technologies that may exist that we cannot account for presently. There are a lot of different avenues. And so it makes all the sense in the world why government agencies would monitor UFO websites, because they want to see what the civilian, you know, populace is saying about this sort of thing. And I think that the UFO phenomenon, ever since the genesis, or rather I should say at very least its introduction to the public, is a popular field of study and a point of particular interest culturally and whatnot. It's always been something that is involved in some capacity, the military. Look at what else we've been talking about on the show for weeks now. Richard French, the retired lieutenant colonel, who had actually been involved with debunking UFOs, so he says, and I think he probably had been. He'd been with the Operation of Special Invest or the Office of Special Investigations with the Air Force, and had actively gone about what John Keel would have called the kind of weirdish MIB kind of stuff, where he would go to someone's house and act strange, try and drink a bowl of Jell-O, and then write a report about something that someone claimed that they'd seen and dumb it down so that it sounded like there was less actually to be reported than what had actually happened. Now, he goes on to make some strange claims, but the point is yet again, it is very evident the reason why, and of course the obvious presence of these organizations in officialdom and their interest in UFO phenomenon. So I find it interesting, and yeah, I've kind of gotten to a point where, you know, I'm beyond being paranoid about it. It's just, if you're going to do this kind of research, you know, you're going to have that. You're going to encounter that, and you're going to hear kind of freakishly weird stories that may involve people saying that they've been told to shut up and not talk to you if you're a researcher. And I've had that happen too.
When you hear stories about people like Richard French going in and trying to drink the bowl of Jell-O, do you think the government just tells these guys, like, look, man, act weird.
Go in there.
Freak them out into telling you.
Dress like an Oompa Loompa.
It's like, because think about it. When bouncers are at bars, I'm friends with a couple of bouncers, and every time I see them, they're walking around with these crazy eyes looking intimidating because, you know, if anybody's going to start any trouble, they're going to see this guy looking all intimidating and be like, okay, I'm not going to mess with him. So I wonder if the government's just like, okay, just go in there, act like Rip Taylor, freak these guys out, and they're going to tell you, yep, we've seen aliens.
Act a certain way, yeah. And that's the thing, is that maybe that, I mean, a lot of it has to do with psychological warfare. I mean, there are a lot of different methods of psychological intimidation, you know, or confusion tactics that are put forth. In addition to all those things, then, of course, there is the misinformation aspect. You know, this is something that's been coming up a lot recently with the discussion of Robert Hastings and his reasons for not going to the citizens' hearing on UFO disclosure. One of the things he had said was that he had been a bit disenfranchised with Stephen Greer, or rather, I'm sorry, Stephen Bassett. They were both there. And the fact that there were people up there on this panel that were talking about Majestic 12 like it was actually something of relevance. And yet Hastings and others had actually worked to essentially debunk the famous MJ-12 documents. And they say that this has already been shown to be completely misinformation. Whatever William Moore, the researcher who had allegedly been working alongside this group calling themselves the Aviary, whatever was actually going on there, it's not something that can be taken as reliable UFO data. And yet I always point back, and I'm not saying that Majestic 12 documents are real or that they need to be taken seriously, which I also hear, by the way, that Stanton Friedman, even off the record, had told Robert Hastings that he thought that they were probably, it was just as likely that they were phony, I think is what he said. But I think that one thing that is often forgotten is the fact that there was a Canadian government memo that was released. And this government memo said something about there being an investigation by the Canadian government into this panel of 12 or so individuals that was overseen by a scientist named Vannevar Bush in the United States, and that they had been interested in this organization, and apparently because of their alleged connection to studies of scientific studies and secretly of UFOs.
All right, Grimerica, where are you on this one?
Well, you know, this is the thing, is that I think it's interesting because MJ-12 is interesting only in the context primarily that it does appear to have been, you know, a misinformation campaign that was fed to certain UFO researchers, and it kind of muddied the water. And yet this document, I believe, was found in the Canadian National Archives, and it seems to suggest that back, maybe at least by the 1950s, the Canadians were aware of there being a group in the United States that they seem to have been, not only have taken interest in, but that seemed to also match what MJ-12 was supposed to have been. So I'm not saying that that proves MJ-12 was legitimate. All I'm saying is that, again, I think that there are elements of information that are both good and bad that often come out in a misinformation campaign, and part of the reason for that is, you know, I think government officials, if they're interested in UFO reports and what people claim that they're seeing, they know they're not going to dissuade people from believing. They're not going to be able to retract and remove certain information. And so what they have to do is they have to put out misleading information paired with information that actually is of some substance and that actually is verifiable. And that way, I guess the old axiom, the best place to hide something is right out in the open. That kind of comes back into play. And they're able better to dissuade people or to misdirect people by pairing bad evidence or bad information with a little bit of good information just as well. I think that more often that's probably what has to happen. And speaking of good and bad information, I think just the other day I may have spoken with someone who claims that he met John Teeter. I'll say that again. This guy claims he met John Teeter. We have audio, and we'll be talking about that next here on the Graylian Report. Misinformation, information, time travel, who knows? I'm Micah Hanks. Stay tuned. back to the program. I'm Micah Hanks. We're going to wrap up this final segment of Hour 1, and then we'll be talking with Harry Hubbard during Hour 2, The Mystery Caves of Illinois. You know, I have my Sierra Club guide to spelunking right here on the desk. It's the kind of thing you want to keep when you broadcast from a cave underground.
Yeah.
You can see it's been through a... Well, it's been a little time underground, probably.
Trampled by Hadels.
Yeah. That book's been through it, but... I want to address something funny that happened the other day. We're all over the place tonight because there's a lot to talk about, and, well, you know, no better time to get to it than the present.
Unless we've had a lot of coffee.
Unless, actually, there is a past guest who's going to be coming on, or perhaps a wave from the future that needs to be addressed. You see where I'm going with this? Remember the old, the joke? The past, the present, the future walked into a bar. Man, it was tense. So, anyway... I was on this program the other day. Now, the program broadcasts on KZUM out of Lincoln, Nebraska. The program's called Exploring Unexplained Phenomena with Scott Colborn. I've been a guest on Scott's program a couple of times, and something unprecedented happened this week while I was on the program. A caller called into the show, and initially we've been talking about UFOs, and then he just very casually says, "When I met John Teeter just a few years ago," and so when it comes back around and I'm able to talk to him about this... Well, I'll tell you what. Rather than telling you the story, I'm going to let you hear it. Here's an excerpt from the audio of that program, only for purposes of illustrating what happened while I was there. This guy, again, claims he met John Teeter, and here's what he had to say.
Okay, we're going to go to the question, or the caller rather, and maybe a second question from them. Were you interested in talking about time travel?
Yes, I was, yes.
Go ahead, sir.
I met John Teeter some years ago, and one of the predictions he made before he left was Hawking would change his idea on black holes about things being emitted and came up with the idea of Hawking radiation. And the reason I think this Hawking radiation is so important was because John Teeter said he used many black holes in his time travel, and if they can detect this Hawking radiation, that may be one way they can see whether these many black holes exist. And I'd like to say that I do follow time travel on the internet, and I know something of it, and I think some people making some of these other claims are a bit too extravagant for my taste.
Where'd you meet John Teeter at?
I met him in Las Vegas.
Are you familiar with the quote-unquote story or legend of John Teeter, Micah?
I certainly am. Now, hold on. So the caller addressing that, Roger, so you say that you met a man who claimed to be John Teeter many years ago.
Yeah.
What? Okay, that's fascinating, because obviously John Teeter has been a very interesting story for many, many years. There have been conspiracy theories and all this that relates, you know, for those in the listening audience who aren't familiar with who John Teeter is, but again, you know, primarily his communications have been through message forums and whatnot on the internet. So
now, the casual observer here can probably tell I'm a little skeptical about what this guy is saying. I always believe in being nice to people and hearing them out, but naturally, I mean, for those who have followed the John Teeter story, they know that this individual had only posted on online message forums. So I was a bit skeptical, but nonetheless, it's incredibly interesting because this guy is saying, hey, I mean, you know, let's give him the benefit of the doubt. Maybe he did meet John Teeter. Here's what he went on to say.
So, Roger, you say that you actually met John Teeter.
Yes, I did, yeah.
May I ask also, what else John Teeter, or the man claiming to be John Teeter, what else had he told you during the meeting, and under what circumstances were you able to meet him?
Well, it was a chance meeting. I met him when I was in Las Vegas at a chess tournament, and he told me a number of things about myself in the future that nobody else was able to tell me. And what else? I can't jar my memory right now,
Had John Teeter claimed that he had known you in the future?
Yeah, he knew who I was, and I didn't know who he was.
And was it a conversation, Roger, that took place in a public setting at this chess tournament?
We were at a chess tournament.
Did you have lunch or dinner?
No. We were
drinks
at
drinks or
we were. I was at the chess tournament because I was there to play, and he just happened to be there in Las Vegas at this hotel. I said, "Well, come back to my room. We're having a party."
Did he seek you out? How was the introduction made?
I told him who I was, and he knew instantly who I was, and I didn't know him.
Did you just, in terms of establishing friendship, did you walk up and say, you know, hello, I'm Roger, and then this was all sprung upon you? But how was that first introduction made?
I just told him my name was Roger, and he was walking in the hall claiming to be a time traveler, and people were just laughing at him, saying...
Oh, I see. So there had been some sort of pre-introduction statements by him to other people.
And people didn't believe it, no. And then he knew who I was instantly, so he invited me back to his room. He said there would be a party back there. And I got back there, and then that's when he tried to use his time travel machine. And, of course, the beings that are protecting me didn't allow it. But I like to tell your guests, too, that ETs do exist, and ET is synonymous with time traveler, but time travelers from our future are also coming back, so we do have human time travelers. And the thing I find so interesting about Hawking changing his idea about black holes is John Titor predicted this before it happened. And I think once they can, if these mini black holes have this signature, this Hawking radiation, they can find this, then they know for sure that these mini black holes exist. And according to time, John Titor, he used these mini black holes in his time travel, so that should be the beginning of things.
Micah, just as a point of reference here, I followed a little bit of this John Titor story over the years, and the attorney for the family, in which right now the what would be the young or adolescent boy that later would be the adult John Titor, they chose to move not too many years ago to the area right outside of Omaha, Nebraska. We're about 59 miles in straight line from Omaha here. So,
and I'd also like to tell your guests, I have no reason to make this up because I'm a contactee myself. What I'm doing stands on my own. It's just that I happen to run across this guy, and I know this guy exists and that these other beings do use time travel, but I have no reason to create this story. You know?
And that's in essence what the gentleman had to say. So what do you think about that? You think that he actually met the time traveler John Titor?
Great Scott, Marty!
That was interesting to me. I mean, I hate to say it. Maybe Roger did meet John Titor. I don't know. I'd have to see more proof. That's how I'm going to term it right now. I'd have to see more proof. But I think I'm one of the only people that I know who's ever met or at least been introduced to someone over the phone like that who claimed that they had met John Titor. Now, I believe as the host Scott Colborn actually pointed out, there apparently is a family and an attorney. Tyler, I think you brought this up too. There's an attorney, I think, who represents what is allegedly John Titor's family, something along those lines. And they claim that, I guess, John Titor is a kid right now, or I don't know. Heck, he might be getting closer to being an adult. It's been a few years since John Titor first appeared on the web.
I don't know what you guys are talking about. John Ritter's been dead for a while.
It gets so convoluted. I don't know what to think. The guy's coming back for like an IBM
what was he like saying he was coming, what was it, was it a calculator or was it an old IBM computer, right?
It's a part of an old IBM computer, because apparently was there like a nuclear episode or something that rendered most of the electrical grid useless and resulted in like the fracturing of empires.
It's all the same sort of stuff that we hear about, but essentially in every conspiracy theory that's ever dawned since Alex Jones. And speaking of conspiracy theories, we've only got about a minute left in this hour. I do want to point this out. If you're not already reading the daily news that we have at the Gralian Report, do check that out. Every day we put up a news roundup, and one of the lead stories today had to do with the fact that, yes, it's that time of the year again. The Bilderbergers are having their annual meeting, and the folks at Infowars.com actually released the guest list name this year, you know, former members of, or rather attendees at Bilderberger meetings. I guess technically it's Bilderberg. It was named after the Bilderberg Hotel in Holland, where the first meeting was held, I believe, in 1954, if I have my years correct. But Kathleen Sebelius, who had been one of the appointees to the Obama administration early on, I think also Timothy Geithner, both Bill and Hillary Clinton, virtually every U.S. president for the last, 45 years or so. I mean, they've all essentially been involved with the Bilderberg conspiracy. And why is it a conspiracy? Well, because they basically are defined as being what you might call a high-level lobbying group, okay, with essentially extreme political clout both in the United States and in Europe. And yet they basically can move about and carry out all their endeavors by complete cover of silence. Nobody seems to know exactly what they talk about. Members of the press, you know, the editors of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, you know, both political parties. If you're influential and you're in politics, or if you're someone of interest to the media or anything else like that, you're likely to end up at a Bilderberg meeting, as long as you're of use to them. And other than that, we're not going to be told anything about what they do. When we come back, you're going to be told all about Harry Hubbard, our guest this week on the Graylin Report. I'm Micah Hanks. Stay tuned. We'll be back right after this.
Conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylin Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Welcome back to the program. It is the Graylin Report, keeping you company every Tuesday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Glad to do it. We've deputized ourselves and made ourselves, well, whatever it is we are to you, and we're thankful for that. It's been a lot on the table tonight, and here in just a few minutes, we're going to be talking with Harry Hubbard. Mr. Hubbard is an expert on a lot of different things. He is an expert on Fortiana, as well as a series of strange caves beneath Illinois. But before we get to him, I do want to point out a couple of things, brief announcements and the like, and one of those has to do with the fact that there is an all-new issue of Gray Street now available. Caleb, is this correct?
Indeed, sir.
What do we have to look forward to in this latest edition of Gray Street?
On this edition, you get to see the Red Pill Baron flying in his biplane, sort of. It's a refurbished ex-baseball player plane.
Use your big boy voice.
Micah, he's drunk, he's texting, and he's running from flying saucers.
I'm not texting anybody right now. But, I'm always excited to see the latest updates with Gray Street. And, of course, that's going to be something great to look forward to. And if you are already one of us, but you are not yet following Gray Street, I implore you, if you're really a Graylin, you need to go and take a look at this. And to find it, all you have to do is just go to the main webpage there, graylinreport.com, and you'll see the little banner there on the middle of the page. From that banner, you can click that, and it'll take you to Gray Street, which is, at present, it's been updated weekly. And I just know that there's a lot of work that goes into that for Caleb, so.
Yeah, I basically stay up all night and do it. It's great. And I will say to the fans that very soon we will be getting into some of the cryptids, because that's kind of what the comic series is going to go towards. So keep watching.
Well, you know, something else that the comic has featured recently is, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that goes on underground.
Indeed.
Caves are really a part of what we do here at the Graylin Report. Now, the most famous, highly adapted cave animal, the European blind, long-legged, long-snouted, depigmented salamander. Okay. Long ago, did you know that that animal was tentatively identified as a baby dragon? People actually thought that's what it was. Maybe it was actually a baby Hadal. Now, in the mid-16th century, a European author described a cave from which ancient bones were removed and sold as those of unicorns, and thus man over the ages has creatively explained different things that he's found within caves. The truth, as we know it scientifically today, may be less spectacular, but no less interesting, and yet there are those interesting instances where it appears that there is a little more going on behind the scenes. Our guest tonight, Harry Hubbard, happens to be an expert on strange things found in caves, as well as Fortiana and UFO phenomenon. I'll hope to be able to speak about all these things with him a bit. And first, I want to welcome into the program Mr. Hubbard. Thank you for joining us on the Graylin Report.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
very good to have you with us. Now, what I am most interested in talking about tonight, of course, is since we're all talking about caves here, you have done a lot of research over the years. Perhaps you're the foremost expert on a series of caves in Illinois, and there are very extraordinary things that have been found in those caves. Now, I am an expert, well, at least so far as knowing what's in those caves, but I'd rather allow you to tell our listeners all about that. So where does this peculiar story begin, and how did you come to take such interest in ancient artifacts, perhaps from halfway around the world, that may exist in caves beneath Illinois?
Well, actually, the cave would be a little stretched. This is an actual man-made cavern system. It is a man-made cavern that extends from our research probably a couple hundred feet, with 13 crypts in it, as described by a man who was actually in there during the 1980s. And what he started pulling out certain items, and they had different types of ancient script on them. And of course, here in America, if anything's got ancient script on it, oh, it's got to be fake. It's got to be fake. So the experts kind of sloughed it off, and there weren't anybody here, as far as American scholarship, that could decipher any of these tablets. So there were a few people who made some good attempts, but they never were able to pin down exactly what language it was, and where the actual artifacts came from, or at least the bulk of them had come from. And I had met Paul Shafranca in 1992, I believe it was. And I collected several books on the kind of like the underground circuit concerning this cave here in Illinois. And he took an interest in it. We had cut one of our first videos in the winter of 1994, then he took it up again as I introduced it to him. I believe it was in the summer of 1993. He took it up again in 94, and actually he did bust the script. It was an archaic. The main form of writing was an archaic form of Latin, and there were also Phoenician characters mixed in with it, Greek characters. There's some Greek in here, a lot of Egyptian glyph, a lot of Numidian, Berber, ancient Berber. But the bulk of the language is archaic Latin, and these stones told an incredible story, the tablets.
Wow. It is indeed an incredible story. And the way that you fit into this is just as incredible to me, Harry. Now, you and Paul, again, you started off around 1993, 1994, and really shortly thereafter, you had a website up devoted to this. Am I correct?
That's correct. Our initial website went up on Memorial Day of 1997. And back then, not so many people had internet. If you did have internet, it was dial-up. And so I wanted to have a website that was easy to upload, easy to download, where people with slow connections could go through it rather quickly. And that is still the essential website that we have today. So that's got tons of pictures on it, lots of information and data, and it's hundreds and hundreds of files, and it's still under, like, you know, 200 megs or so. It's very small in size, but we made it so it would be fast to look at, and we haven't really changed it. We haven't seen the need to change it.
It's efficient, then. That's what we like, right?
Well, I see a lot of people with really fancy websites nowadays that are extremely flashy, but for what we were doing, for what we had, the information that we had no competition. And so it's basically data, raw data, information, on, and there no one else had that information, so we kind of wanted to get it out there as an information site and a learning tool. So we weren't concerned with the commercial aspect of it at that point.
And, you know, you've certainly done a good job with educating people with regard to all this over the years. Now, speaking of education, my personal education into this area of thought, in other words, that there may be things that were going on in the pre-Columbian sense, in other words, before Christopher Columbus arrived here in 1492, there seems to be a rich history of the happenings here in the United States and things that were also being carried out by people who were not from here, people from other parts of the world who were traveling to the Americas. I remember an article that David Hatcher Childress had actually written, who we met for the first time just back in February, and Childress had talked about, of all things, a cave in the Grand Canyon that apparently had later been sealed up by the Smithsonian, but that he believed that there were Egyptian relics in there. So how often is that the kind of thing that we hear about, Harry?
David H. Childress is the Renaissance man, and there are many things that I believe we would not know, the public at large would not know of today had it not been for his recreating it into printed materials. And yes, the episode that happened in the Grand Canyon falls hand in hand with this site and so many other sites in this country. We have since learned of all kinds of people finding ancient coins, finding ancient relics that are clearly of North African, Mediterranean descent and origin. And if you go back to the 1800s, so many writers in the 1800s, from early 1800s up to the early 1900s, there were so many speculators that the Carthaginians had come here, the Phoenicians had come here, that the Libyans, ancient Romans, everybody had come here. And I was, as I was young, my father, he was into ancient sites. He grew up out west, and he had studied the Anasazi sites, and I grew up, him carrying me to different mounds and sites and this and that. And so by the time I was in my teens, I was convinced that the ancient Romans had been here. I was convinced of it. I just had to prove it. And I just went on I figured that something had happened in the timeline sometime around 0 BC. And I just went looking for it. And sooner or later in life, I stumbled across what I feel is pretty positive evidence that, yes, there was Mediterranean influences all over this country.
That's such an incredible story, and the implications of that. I mean, that alone, if there had only been Romans, you know, of course, you mentioned all these other different individuals who possibly could have come to the Americas. So what I would like to know is, you know, what led you to that determination? Obviously, you kind of, at the outset, you had a hunch, but what led to the determination in the long run that this is what was going on, and what evidence really convinced you, and at what point were you just like, wow, right here it is, it's right before me, and it's undeniable?
It's a hard sell, I'll tell you. But I was preaching it from my soapbox because there are too many ancient villages that are spectacular that took an organized discipline to create all throughout Georgia where I grew up. And there's one river there that's got 2,000 mound sites just on the one river.
Wow.
And they were everywhere. Ohio, Indiana, all over Illinois, Kentucky, Tennessee, Alabama. Ancient earthworks everywhere, in the mountains, in the plains, in the valleys, in the floodplains, everywhere. So, and as I started collecting more and more books and reading more, it's like, wow, it's just impossible. The Indians could not have done that. And we're, as I was taught in school, that Columbus came here and he met all the Indians. the Indians were here first. Where did they come from? So, and I never, ever, and I still do not believe or buy the Bering Strait theory. I think that is the biggest sham, and that is one of the things that I really depose in a forum is the Bering Strait theory. It's just a bunch. It's just a crock wash. There's nothing to it at all. Nothing to back it up.
So, if not the Bering Strait, what would have been the more likely way that early, I guess, arrivals to the United States would have taken place?
Well, my wife is from Singapore, and she tells me that in China, the actual curriculum, they teach that the Chinese had trade back and forth with North America, the west coast of North America.
Really?
And Chinese influence all through western North America, on into Central America, and into South America on the west coast. They teach it in their curriculum. Okay, well, fine. And over here, it's just obvious that that they have washed it, and I guess you call the powers that be. The Smithsonian Institute had a lot to do with that in the late 1800s of just washing it and just institutionalizing history, and this is how history is, lock, stock, and barrel. And then after World War II, they rewrote history again and really washed a bunch more of the items away.
the story of history, in other words, seems to have a lot more to do with who is writing that history. And I've always, Harry, I've always been skeptical of the Smithsonian Institute. And one of the primary reasons for that takes us back to the research of the late zoologist Ivan Sanderson. And he was quite the Fortean scholar just as well. He talked about, I think, on the island of Shemya, finding these giant skeleton bones. He said that the femur was, you know, twice the length of a man's, that the skulls were big enough to fit down on top of a person's head like a helmet, and that there were sharp teeth in these things, but that when the Smithsonian Institute had been contacted and brought in to investigate, what did they do? They came in, they swept these things away, and now no one knows where they went. And yet, apparently, in the 1890s, even some of the people who worked with the Smithsonian, I think we had Cyrus Thomas, who had been there with the Bureau of Ethnology, they had been involved in the recovery of these giant bones. Where do they all go?
Well, Cyrus Thomas is one of the problems.
Oh, really?
He was one of the big issues, and I tell you what, if I ever get to meet him in the afterlife, I will slap him. from what I'm speaking to you, about 1 mile due north of me, there was a log tomb there found, and it had giants in it. They have discovered mounds in the Cahokia complex that had giants. Nebraska, they have found giants in mounds. Oklahoma, they found mounds with giants in it. And they try to cover it up. But not just giants, but other human anomalies also. William Corliss records a lot of it. Concerning mounds where short people with six fingers and six toes on each appendage, you know, were found. People with extra rows of teeth, extra ribs, extra vertebrae in the back. It's not a subtle flirtation. It is. These are different races of people that we try to wash over because it doesn't fit the Darwinian theory of evolution. I can't prove to you any Darwinian theory of evolution, but I can for sure prove to you de-evolution. The giants were here. Small people were here. There's villages out west where the doors are like 18, 20 inches tall. Just everywhere. There's human anomalies just throughout this country and throughout the world. We just, see a little more of it here because so many people haven't been there to take it home and put it in their cabinet yet. So
in their cabinet. You know, it's funny because, Harry, we're about to go to a break, but when we come back, I want to talk about some of your books and the things that you've written about this. But I remember a story Brad Steiger told me years and years ago. He was well aware of those skeletons, the giant skeletons, and he said, you know, I would keep those in the photographs of these things that people had actually attained over the years, and I would keep them and use them in my presentations. But eventually, people had to stop. I had to stop using these illustrations in these presentations I'd give because people were contacting me after I would use them. And I said, what's the problem? And Brad Steiger told me, you know, these illustrations that you're showing of our personal collections of giant skeletons and things are causing problems. Well, what kind of problems, Brad said? And he said, you know what? There are mysterious fires that are taking out these private collections in museums. And so many people's collections, apparently, over the years, according to Brad, have been lost. It's just incredible. Harry, stay with us. We'll be back right after this. It's an incredible conversation. Really enjoying talking with you. This is the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks, and when we come back, we'll continue this discussion with Harry Hubbard, and we're going to get a little bit more into the mystery caves under Illinois right after this. It is the Graylian Report. Stay tuned.
Carl Sagan once wrote that the questioning mind needs to be instilled with both skepticism and wonder, for the universe is a pretty big place, filled with undelved mysteries, sciences, and life that we've barely begun to comprehend. Every month, Intrepid Magazine brings you both the wondrous and the skeptical. Intrepid Magazine focuses on science, metaphysics, UFOs, politics, conspiracies, and unexplained phenomena, all offered up by Intrepid's cadre of writers and contributors, comprised of a host of seasoned authors, pundits, and recognized names in their fields. The universe is indeed a big place, and where other magazines leave off, Intrepid Mag is just beginning. Subscribe to Intrepid Magazine today at www.intrepidmag.com. That's www.intrepidmag.com.
Welcome back to the Grayling Report. I'm Micah Hanks, and tonight we're looking a bit at history, but maybe not the history that you learned about when you were in grade school, or maybe even in college for that matter. Our guest is Harry Hubbard, and we've been talking about the mystery caves beneath Illinois. We've actually been all over the map, because really this is a very, very, very widespread phenomenon. We've talked a little bit about giants, little people, and all different kinds of things, but Harry, I want to come back down to the central focus here of tonight, which is this anomalous... Again, like you pointed out, it's not actually a cave. It's a cavern that was built beneath Indiana. I'm fascinated by this. I've heard stories for years, and you've authored a couple of books about this, too, as I understand, correct?
Yes, actually in Illinois, southeastern Illinois.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And our webpage is IllinoisCaves.com, and you can order the books as e-books at AlexanderHelios.com. And we're also on Facebook as The Illinois Caves. It's a guest invitation or something where you can just go and see a lot of the artifacts and replicas of artifacts and ask questions of me or Paul or Zach Taylor, who has our heads our publicity at ZTTconsulting.com. So we're out there, and we're not too difficult to find, but what actually had happened was that these people had whisked up an ancient sema of Mediterranean kings, Egyptian kings, but they were Greek. It's the Ptolemaic dynasty, and they were brought over here and permanently interred. And there are people, and have been people, searching for them for decades, over in Africa and Egypt, all different places near the Mediterranean Sea, and they're looking on the wrong continent. And we just figure that one of these days, when this becomes super big in publicity, they're still going to be over there looking for the same thing, you know, because that's what their livelihood has been for so long, and they're just driven by speculation. They have no idea what it is they're looking for. Otherwise, they would have done more research. So. Yeah,
I agree. And I want to throw out also, kudos not only to you and Paul, but also to Zach, who you'd mentioned there, who handles a lot of your web presence. Zach had contacted me before the program, and he actually had mentioned that there was a special promotion for folks who want to get your books if they're listening to the program. Is it okay if I mention that promotion now?
Oh, yes, please, by all means.
Yeah, absolutely.
He does that for listeners of programs, yes.
That was very kind of him. And apparently, if you'd like to check out some of Harry's work, you can actually use the order code GRAYLIAN20, and that's going to get you a 20% discount coupon if you want to check out some of Harry's work right now. I wanted to throw that out there for you because I, too, am an author, and I know how vital it is to be able to sell those books in these economically woeful times. Now, so when we're talking about African and Mediterranean presences in the United States, and we're talking about the potential that some of these individuals were interred beneath Illinois, not Indiana, I think I misspoke earlier, who exactly do we believe is down there?
The entire Ptolemaic dynasty. We have been saying now for 20 years running that the entire Ptolemaic dynasty is interred here in Marion County, Illinois. And in that time, no one the world over has proven us wrong on any aspect of our claims. And we got it all. We didn't make it up. We did our research. And the Ptolemaic dynasty ruled Egypt after Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great founded the dynasty in a sense. Ptolemy Soter I was his half-brother. Soter I got Alexander the Great's body, and it went all the way down to Cleopatra VII. And you know, there's so many people that have no clue of what's the connection between Alexander the Great and Queen of Queens, Cleopatra. They don't know history, and in America, it is something that is just not taught. This dynasty that was begat by Alexander the Great ruled Egypt for over 300 years, and the end of the dynasty was Queen of Queens, Cleopatra. And they didn't know. I mean, even scholars here didn't know that Alexander the Great was connected to Cleopatra. And I'm just wondering, how come all the scholars that are in Egypt today, they don't realize it? They're looking for Alexander the Great's grave or tomb, mm-hmm. and they have no clue that they were all buried together. So, you know, I don't get it, you know. It was, oh, well, we're looking for Cleopatra's grave. We're looking for her tomb, her and Mark Anthony. Well, they were all buried together. And they were all shown together. So why not look for a cavern system that has 13 crypts, one of them's a woman, and the main crypt is interred in a solid gold coffin. And that's what we had here. This guy had written some books in the early 1990s stating that he had found a cavern system, a man-made cavern system that had 13 crypts. The main crypt had a solid gold coffin, and they were all mummified. They were all very, very old, and one of them was a woman who had bore several children. Well, that narrows it down, because there aren't that many ancient kings buried in a solid gold coffin. And so you can start from there and kind of work sideways and work back. So, and I've always been accused of Hubbard is working backwards. Well, if you're working with ancient history, isn't that what you're supposed to do? I don't know any other way to approach ancient history except to work backwards.
It would seem to make sense. Now, what's so compelling about all this is that I think that whether people choose to believe it or not, the simple explanation would be to say, you know what, if these remnants are down there in a cavern, just go and dig them out of the earth, show everyone. But it's not that simple, is it? As I understand, there are, I don't know if you'd call it political issues, but the owner of the land apparently is not that fond of allowing you or anyone else, for that matter, into these caverns to be able to prove once and for all
Everybody is greedy. Everybody wants to cash out. You know, everybody wants to be a multi-gazillionaire, you know, and at the expense of an ignorant public, I guess you could say. So that's our issue now, is everybody wants to make millions of dollars. And so that's where we stand.
Really? So
you are correct.
And I do know the backstory there about the present landowner, whom you know, but who apparently is selling. Correct me if I'm wrong, he has the land for sale for $1 million, but doesn't want anyone to go into the cave at present to be able to determine, I'm sorry, the cavern, to determine conclusively.
Yeah. Exactly. He wants $1 million for it, and hey, it's his. He can if he wants, and his whole deal is, well, Harry, if it's not there, then nobody's going to offer me more money for it. But I'm like, okay, for $1 million, somebody could turn that over in a matter of days and become a multi billionaire.
As long as
it took me $800,000 in several years, almost 8 years, to determine. Yes, bingo, it's right there. We have it right here. This is where it's at. And so, you know, and by that time I was tabbed clean, I've just kind of been waiting in limbo, hoping that somebody else would come in and help with the research and do what I've done. But there aren't too many Harry Hubbards in the world. I guarantee you that.
There aren't. Well, Harry, I'll tell you this. If I ever become rich, I'll buy the property and then I'll let you down.
Oh, I would too. I would too. You know, I mean, what is a tomb full of ancient Mediterranean kings worth on today's market? You got it.
But to people like you and I, you know, the simple answer is it's priceless. If that is really what's in a cavern in Illinois, that's priceless. There's not a price that you could put on that. This is history, and yet, again, it's incredible, and I think the people, if that's exactly what's going on here, and that's what's, and we have no reason to disbelieve you. I think you've done a fantastic job with the research, but we can't get down into the cavern. If we could just get down there, there wouldn't be any question. But the problem is that there is so much bureaucracy, and there is so much. I mean, this is something I think that's plagued us for
it's
more than a,
the human element.
It is, and people, like you said, they're more interested in profiting from something, and that's okay. I don't think it's bad that someone wants to turn.
You know, years ago, I used to take artifacts and go to the FBI office in Effingham, Illinois, And I'm the, you know, a lot of people are scared to death of the FBI, and I would go into their office, and man, these guys would like hide under their desk. They would like, hey, I'm like, man, I got two cases of artifacts I want to show you. We gotta get out of here. I'm like, man, I'm the best chaser away of the FBI agents ever.
That's,
you know,
usually...
they didn't want to. They'd seen my stuff two or three times. They didn't want to see any more. They're like, ah, they're gonna have to do something, you know.
So, oh my so gosh!
They were gone. You know?
Were they?
I guess that was my cologne or something. You know?
Oh no, it probably wasn't that. But you know, I think that seems to be the ongoing issue with officialdom just as well. You bring something of importance to
Correct.
People's attention, and they say, "Oh, okay, well, we'll take a look at it, but later, not right now." Oh goodness.
Yeah.
You know, I know that as a researcher over the years, and I don't want to stray too far off topic, but I have to say, you know, being a person who's interested in UFOs, you've also been a UFO researcher. Have you encountered that same attitude when you've been involved in unidentified flying object research?
Well, now you're kind of touching on the fringe of another reason why people don't want this tomb brought into the light, because there are so many alien contact artifacts in there.
Really?
In place. I did a video. It's called Aliens from the Lost Tomb. And I believe it's on the Harry Hubbard channel of YouTube, where I show like 30. And then there's on Vimeo, I think I show another 40 that aren't in. But there's a lot of these tablets. That was another reason why the scholars just ran. They just ran away from us. There was, I wouldn't say direct contact, but there was definitely eyewitness observations between ships and alien people in atmospheric suits, male and female, throughout this tomb. I mean, there's just dozens and dozens of them. And there are other artifacts also that are not so politically correct. There is sexually oriented tablets. There are dozens and dozens of beautiful naked women, and they're carved on these nasty black rocks. And I'm talking incredible ancient artisan of the highest caliber I have ever seen in my life. Beautiful women in different costumes, naked. There are several artifacts depicting women giving birth to children. I mean, in graphic detail. And these are things that people, I guess, don't want their children to see. They don't want to see it on TV. But my gosh, I could do an X-rated video show of just these kind of tablets that are like, wow, and there are just scores of them.
So this was ancient adult entertainment, then, I guess.
I guess that's what, that's good of misnomers, you know, nomenclatures I've seen, but that's another one too, is the fact that there are several of these. But yeah, my father grew up in West Texas and Arizona, and you can't get from one place to the other without going through New Mexico. And I don't know how much time you spent in New Mexico, but you can't be there for very long at all without seeing mysterious lights in the skies. You just cannot do it. It's like the beach in Florida. You're going to see the ocean. In New Mexico, you're going to look up and you're going to see strange stuff. And my father, I guess I was fortunate in a way, he got me interested in aliens, flying saucers or so, at a very early age. It was to him. He had a bunch of books, and I still got his books now, and I've compounded with that. And, you know, I was familiar with the Andresian affair when it first happened. Now, what, 20, 30 years later, it's like, oh, it didn't happen. But for years and years and years, it was real, it was in your hand, and there were no accounts countering it. Well, if it is true, if half of it is true, if one-tenth of it is true, those guys can do anything they want.
You're talking about the alien visitors.
Yes. I don't know that they're aliens. I think they've been here a whole lot longer than we have. I know they've been here a whole lot longer than I've been here.
You know, I'm skeptical of the extraterrestrial... Well, I'm not just skeptical of extraterrestrial hypothesis. I think, to term it more accurately, I think that there are a lot of different possibilities that should be examined. Yeah.
And that brings you around to Fort. Is that I believe that Fort, after he compounded all the knowledge that he had I believe that he started to really, on the fringe, believe that there were different dimensions, the cities in the skies, the strange happenings in the same places all the time, again and again and again, and so many other things, that there were different dimensions. His stationary Earth policy.
Right.
You know, that things of this nature did happen. And if you look at all of the things that we hear and see today, especially January and February of 2012, just last year, all of the strange noises, the rumblings, which I heard myself. I heard of myself working in Carbondale, Illinois one day, 2 years ago. All of these rumbles and the strange groanings that come from the sky somewhere, and we don't hear. What is that? Well, it was like new. Hey, you go back to new lands, and you'll read about it there. You'll read about those strange noises in Book of the Damned, new lands. You'll read about so many of the things that even some of the accomplished UFO researchers that will tell you, well, obviously the triangle shaped UFOs are the one, or ships are the ones that the American military or modern military has created and built. Not so, because Fort records them in the 1800s, the early 1900s. They're not familiar with Fort, and that's why I think Fort's four books should be required reading for every elementary school student, high school student across the country. They should know that material like the back of their hand. And because that way, when they do see a phenomena, they know that is a phenomena that's recorded before.
You know, Ford also talked about, I believe it was an incident, there may have been one in England and one in Ireland, in which the bodies of small farm animals were discovered, and they had been drained of all their blood. And this sounds so much like the chupacabra reports of today. And not just chupacabras, but I mean a lot of different kinds of strange things that we look at today and think of as modern phenomena. Fort had recorded maybe, oh gosh, you know, I mean, he was doing it about 100 years ago, but some of his research had relevance to things that happened even earlier than that.
Well, he said he always cut his research off at the year 1800. He didn't want to go back before then. But a couple of his issues did, but he covered the 19th century so well. And yeah, I actually do have a chupacabra story, which I would like to share sometime in the future, whatever. But
Can we do it now?
Paul is my witness about that, so... And I videotaped the whole doggone thing. It's like, wow. He and I found a fox in the desert that had, I'm going to make the story real short, had two holes in the back of its neck, and it had no blood. It was drained, and there were no splatter marks, no nothing. It was wedged at the edge of the Gila River Canyon. And it's a good story. It's a real good story.
You've just been all over the map here, and that's what's fascinating about you and your work. You know, I'm the kind of person who I go out. I'm lucky if I see a satellite, you know, let alone the ISS flying overhead. You know, I've just been woefully, my life is woefully absent of the strange and unusual, and yet I'm so fascinated with it.
You need to hang out with me and Paul more often.
Well, you know, if I make it up that way, first of all, I'd be so tempted for us to try and steal away down into that cave, but we'd probably either get hurt or in trouble, so...
we're working on it. You know, it is a work in progress, and, you know, to a point, I'm bound by what I can and what I cannot do, and there are forces that keep me from going in this direction and that direction. But if this had happened years ago, I would have written many more books about any, you know, different phenomena. I would have been able to apply myself in different directions, but I've had to stick with this until it is finalized. So I have to do this. I can't leave it. I have tried to leave it a couple of times, but then I lose my friends. So I have to stick with this until the bitter end.
Yeah, whatever that is. When you've gone so far down the path, I guess, as they say, you know, you get to a point where it's very difficult to come back out, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. As soon as somebody buys that land, my fate is sealed. It's a done deal. You know, as far as I'm concerned, it is a done deal. And my name and history I just wish somebody would come and try to prove us wrong. You know, if somebody said, hey, I think I got some bucks here. I can flash over there. I'm going to prove this stupid hairy upper guy wrong. And it hasn't been done. I don't think it ever will be done. I'm pretty sure it won't be done.
Well,
it's here. It's right there, and the artifacts tell the story.
There's something there, and more than anything, I'd almost just like to be able to see you get down there and determine. You know, this has been your life's work, and that's what's so fascinating about it. We're going to come back after this break and finish discussing your life's work. Harry Hubbard is our guest. He's a fascinating individual and a person who's spent a lot of time out there in the field. You know, there's so much armchair research that goes on these days. We have respect for anyone who gets out there and is literally willing to get their elbows dirty and dig around in caves and the like. And Harry Hubbard has certainly done that. We'll talk more about that when we come back right after this. I'm Micah Hanks. It is the Graylian Report. Stay tuned. If you are interested in the unexplained, like I am, then you probably want to know everything there is to know about every place there is out there. Anywhere, not just in the United States or in Britain. You want to know all about all the weird stuff, anywhere it may be. And one of the less often discussed areas of Fortiana and the unexplained is Australia. And that's why the latest book by Andrew Nicholson, Weird Australia, is a must-have for any paranormal enthusiast's collection. It details and documents reports of yowies, bunyips, and all different kinds of strange happenings that have taken place down under. It's Weird Australia by author Andrew Nicholson, available online as an ebook download on Amazon.com. That's Weird Australia. What are you waiting for? Check it out online right now at WeirdAustralia.com. For most of us, chocolate is a guilty pleasure. Come on, admit it. You've got a sweet tooth just like the rest of us. But if I told you that eating chocolate was actually really good for your health and happiness, you'd probably say I was in La La Land. Hey, I wouldn't argue. Here's why. Every batch of the fine handcrafted chocolates at La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate is made from scratch, using organic, fair trade, and 100% natural ingredients. From the first bite, you'll know you're enjoying true quality, and the heart shape isn't the only way you'll feel the love. In fact, every chocolate from La La Land Organics is made by Melody Dawn Germain herself, and according to her own special recipe. You'll be enjoying Ecuadorian heirloom cacao in every bite, along with a selection of wholesome herbs and superfood supplements that not only make La La Land Organics delicious, but really good for your health and happiness. They're all natural, gluten-free, and no dairy, soy, or refined sugars are included, which help them boost your energy, reduce stress, and promote longevity. And as if healthy organic chocolates didn't remove the guilt factor enough, Melody ships all her orders in reusable, food-grade, non-BPA containers designed to eliminate toxic residue and cut down on environmental waste. Be sure and visit Melody's website at www.mdgnewmedia.com. That website again is mdgnewmedia.com. Just click chocolate in the toolbar at the top of the page. You can't miss it. And while you're there, you can see a full list of the ingredients that will be sure to put a smile on your face. And I promise, it's guilt-free. La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate. Why wait? That website again is mdgnewmedia.com. Unearthing the mysteries of planet Earth tonight, and perhaps those kinds of mysteries of our historical past that you may not be so well aware of. Welcome back to the program. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Graylian Report, and our guest is Harold Hubbard. He's really, you know, he referred to David Hatcher Childress of Ancient Aliens fame as being a Renaissance man. Well, Harry, I think you are quite the Renaissance man yourself.
Well, thank you, but, you know, I mean, my hat's off to David H. Childress. I mean, he is the man, so.
Well.
And getting back to Fort, though, talking about his stationary Earth policy, the Earth doesn't spin. It stays in the same spot. Okay, well, the Earth spins, but Kansas stays in the same spot.
Well.
His humor just absolutely befuddles me. I mean, there's no one like him since or before. So.
You know, it's funny because I think, you know, the old expression from Oz is, you know, we're not in Kansas anymore, and that's what comes to mind here. So,
yeah.
Harry,
and, but again, anybody can join us on Facebook at the Illinois Caves. They can get the books. And there's also on www.alexanderhelios.com, there's also a bunch of short articles that I've written, some short stories, and they're all weird, 410 type stuff, like The Big Sink. I went looking for a huge lake one day, and it disappeared right before I got there. And there's some freebies on there, too, Same Daters, which is a 40-in short story about cemeteries. Let's see, and just some other historical stuff there that anything to fit anybody's wallet. And then you have our books that, gosh, when my books were published in hardcover, they were outrageously expensive because there were so many color photographs in there. And they're ancient artifacts, and they're gold artifacts. So you have to do them in color, and it really hurt me hard, you know, as far as publishing them. So with ebook format now, it is much more economical to see these in proper color and in the grade. So
absolutely, the ebook is just absolutely, it's revolutionized the field, and you know, I make good use of that. And of course, again, for folks who are interested in Harry's books, you have an offer code Graylian20 that will get you 20% off those. And I encourage people to take a look at them and learn more about what Harry's done. You know, I find it fascinating. You're a character, and I mean that in the best way, because, you know, you've got a vibrant personality, and you're never going to give up. You're just after this. And,
no, I can't. I'm in the pigeonhole now.
I guess you are. Harry, is there any final word you would like to pass along to our listenership, or maybe a way that they can contact you directly?
Well, if you have questions, post them on the Facebook. We'll get to them. And anyone who's interested in ancient languages, you can see our videos. Paul busted Etruscan. There's a real good video, Etruscan Volume 1, where we show letter by letter, word by word, the Etruscan language. And basically, it is Latin. There's no big secret about it. The experts say that, oh, Etruscan is linguistically isolated, but they forget about Latin, Umbrian, Oscan, Faliscan, which were all right there in the same area. And we have several decipherment videos online. You can YouTube Harry Hubbard. Of course, now on the disinformation highway, you punch in Google Harry Hubbard or Bing him. There's a lot of bad stuff out there about me, too, but take it light as a grain of salt. It's just jealous people. I, like you, like so many other people who are out doing things, we have people who are jealous of us. So they tend to want to print stuff about us that isn't true. So just keep that in mind. But there's a lot out there. We've got, it is good family, wholesome entertainment, and stuff that I think you will enjoy.
Well, thank you so much. And we've certainly enjoyed talking with you tonight, Harry. So we will turn you loose, but keep up the good work and never stop fighting. I'm sure that the ultimate answers we seek are out there. Maybe they're under there in this case just as well.
Well, let's chat again anytime.
Absolutely, and thank you again for being our guest on the Graylian Report. I'll hold you to that,
thank
Harry.
You.
Have a good evening. That's Harry Hubbard, and I tell you, you know, like I said, he is what, in this part of the country, we would call a character, and probably the very best kind. We're going to run out to one more short break, and then when we come back, we're going to try and catch up on just a little bit of the news in the time that we have left. It is the Graylian Report, your weekly one-stop shop for the strange and the unusual, and I'm Micah Hanks, along with Caleb Hanks and Tyler Pittman. Stay tuned, and we'll be back right after this.
Some fun? Maybe get a little bit of insight. Get a lay of the land. Want to know what's really going on? Do what I do. Listen to Future Theater. It airs every Saturday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, on the Inception Radio Network.com. We'll see you there.
All right, it is the final segment of tonight's edition of the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks. Welcome back to the program. You've just heard from Harold Hubbard. He is a very, he is very, you can tell he's very excited about what he does, but I admire that personally. And I'll tell you, so many people who are involved in this area of research, they find after a while that it can drain you. You know, it can drain you, and you can get to a point where you literally begin to get a bit disillusioned, I think. And so it's a bit refreshing to see someone who, you know, I know Harry's been a lecturer, and he's talked about everything from UFOs to Fortiana. His work, I believe, with official organizations, and of course his, I think Harry's done everything from production and music promotion to, of course, his passion, which seems to be ancient mysteries. So I find that fascinating. I hope I'll be an old man one day and I'll be as enthusiastic as Harry is. I hope I'll be as enthusiastic as Tyler. And Tyler, you didn't get in there and ask your question about reptoids. Tyler, you seem disenchanted tonight.
Do I?
Yeah, you seem disenchanted with reptoids, with everything.
I've been harping that for a while now.
Go ahead.
I think the Archons have been draining Tyler's energy.
It's true.
The Archons. Somebody on Twitter, if you're not following us on Twitter, we are Graylian Report, and someone had tweeted at us. They wanted to know where they could find more information about Archons and books on Archons. I told them, talk to Tyler Pittman, since you're the resident Archon expert.
You are the Archon man.
I wouldn't say that.
I would.
We had Rosemary Ellengiley on a few weeks back, and her new book, The Djinn Connection, speaks on Archons a bit in there. I would recommend that. Pick that one up. That's a very good read.
Tyler, have you ever experienced an Archon face-to-face?
I haven't. Have you?
I have. I've seen Freddy's Dead.
That's true. It's also similar to From Beyond.
That is probably my favorite H.P. Lovecraft film. See, here I had news to get to, and now you're gonna make me start talking about movies and sci-fi literature. But that's fun sometimes. You know, back in the day, I used to talk about this sort of thing all the time on the program. And, you know, now everybody goes, I want to hear some more news! Hey, all right, Miss Piggy.
Speaking of some Lovecraft stuff, though, I was speaking with our friend Abby Roberts, and she was talking about how her teacher in school told her that our state capital of North Carolina, Raleigh, North Carolina, was pronounced Relay, North Carolina. The yeah. sunken city of Relay, North Carolina.
Well, her teacher must have gone to Arkham University, or Miskatonic University in Arkham, rather, which is where I actually graduated. Tyler, what was my doctorate in again? Thonic Studies at Miskatonic University, I believe. Yeah.
Tyler was a hypothetical engineer of Millennium Falcons.
I actually worked on the series, you might be familiar with it, Muzzy Language.
They're both lying, folks. Tyler actually is a mathematician, and his area of interest is in non-Euclidean geometry. But anyway, I digress. Yes, I am, by the way, Red Pill Junkie in the chat room just said, Tyler and the Archonauts. That's pretty good, yes, as he flies overhead in his patented RPG drone. You know, about Rosemary Ellengiley, something that she failed to mention on the program, which, you know, she should mention more often, is the fact that she actually holds a PhD. And, you know, again, I don't agree with everything that Rosemary says. I think that the listenership can tell pretty well when they hear me talk. Although I'm polite to people, I am... I'm not a disbeliever or a doubter, but I'm certainly of the more skeptical ilk. And the reason why is because of my experiences with such things as... You know, just what happened last night, seeing the ISS fly overhead, something that seems so phenomenal at the outset. And then if you spend a few minutes trying to scientifically obtain data and determine what you're looking at, and I don't think it's difficult to do that anymore.
Micah Hanks, the skeptical elk.
The skeptical elk, yes. There you go.
You are a moose.
I'm a moose, yeah, well.
Yeah, if anyone questions this skepticism, it was just evidence throughout this past hour.
Yes, I guess it was, yes. Well, you know, yeah, and people were in the chat room having some fun and whatnot, but I'll tell you this. I believe in two things. I believe in being logical, but also I think being polite is important just as well. I have a friend in talk radio here in Asheville. Well, he's independent talk radio now. He left talk radio because he was told that he had to get into arguments with his callers, people who would call into the program, which I should have during the last 10 minutes here opened the phone lines. We haven't done that in a while. But anyway, and that's one thing I don't, I try not to do, even when the guy, the time traveler, or the fellow who said he'd met the time traveler, the guy, I met John Teeter, you know, I'm a little, I find that to be a rather credulous claim, but by the same token, you know, because of course we all know that John Teeter hangs around chess matches in Las Vegas, you know, so.
What you're saying is you're not going to sacrifice being a nice guy for the sake of ratings. That's admirable.
Yeah, yeah, I try to be.
Even though you are an elk.
Do you believe in reptoids?
Actually, Justin in the chat room just posted an incredible reptoid picture.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's actually Bubble Bobble from the NES platform, 1989.
That's a very, very elaborate Bubble Bobble.
Looks like the guy from Enemy Mine.
I think Tyler believes in reptoids, though.
Why, my friend?
I've seen like, your reptoid.
Looks like Gumby in Anaphylactic Shock.
That's right. Well, you know... Do I believe in reptoids? To answer Tyler's question, no. And just to say, I think, therefore, aliens doesn't do it enough for me. In fact, it doesn't even come close. But
so you do not believe in subterranean-dwelling reptilian-based life forms?
I don't personally, but I've come across some compelling reports of people. You know, you obviously know about some of these.
Well, you yourself, earlier in the program... mentioned a news report or something along the lines of cave dragons, salamanders, non-pigmented, I believe.
No. That was during my introduction for Harry Hubbard.
That's correct. So, I mean, yeah. That's a reptilian.
Amphibian.
That's true.
That's amphibian. Yeah, he's not a scaly little guy. He's got skin.
Well...
Curious?
Perhaps there are non-amphibious reptiles... Deep down,
keep digging,
in
Tyler.
Cave in the.
He's almost there.
We know dinosaurs live underground.
That's right. You know, okay. Getting serious for just a moment. This is what's terrifying. Two stories I did want to get to. We almost don't have time.
Just
for
quickly, that thing that was put in the chat looks sure. like a crazy Care Bear.
Oh, a crazy Care Bear with scales, right? Or is it an amphibian also?
I don't know what it is.
I almost don't want to get serious at this point, but, you know, I'm going to feel bad if I don't mention these two stories. One.
We get scolded if we're...
In the great state of Florida, where our friends Betty June and Rose live, a couple of our favorite Graylians, a school has apparently drawn criticism for using retinal scans for purposes of tracking students without parental permission. First of all, I didn't know that retinal scans were actually... Tyler laughs, and maybe rightly so. I wasn't even aware of the fact that retinal scans were being utilized to track or to observe elements of the populace.
Who's paying for this equipment?
Well, apparently the parents
are actually taxpayer.
You know, that's great. Because I remember when I was in school, you couldn't buy 15 sheets of poster board, but now they have retinal scanners.
Yeah.
This is a true story, and it was brought to my attention a few days ago. You guys need to look this up for yourselves. When we are scanning the eyeballs of children, you know, putting them in... I mean, we don't know what this stuff does. I mean, yeah, I'm sure there's a safe way to do it, but if parents weren't even notified... Really, what is the need for scanning the eyeballs of
elementary
school students?
They want to make sure
these
kids don't have weapons of mass destruction, Tyler.
Well, that's the sad thing, is that apparently...
You have astigmatism.
Apparently...
Weapons of mass astigmatisms.
Well, apparently kids, you know, do these days bring knives to school. I think the difference is that every now and then, a child who may be old enough to have known better, but young enough to have not known the difference, a child like that may bring a pocket knife or something like that to school and didn't intend any harm. They should have known better than to do that, but they didn't intend any harm. And I think that in an instance like that, if it had happened in 1953, no one would have asked the question. A teacher would have asked for the pocket knife, looked at it, said, "That's nice. My dad had one like that. Hand it back to him." In 2013, you know, that kid's going to be tackled, and they're going to put him in juvie for, you know, 6 months.
These sixth graders are piloting drones.
But this is the other thing, too, and I'm not saying that...
You can stab someone with a pencil. It happened to me.
Well, that's the whole point, is that, you know, I mean, it's not what the weapon can do, it's what the individual can do. You know, and that's the whole point is that, you know, it, whether it's guns, knives, anything like that. But I digress, because the other point I wanted to get to here, and this is the other story, the Supreme Court. This is probably the most important story of the last week. And to me, this is the one that is that begs the most attention. The Supreme Court decision, the justices of the U.S. Supreme Court have determined that a DNA swab after a person's arrest is a legitimate portion of a search. In other words, if you are arrested by an officer of the law, they can take a Q-tip and they can swab the inside of your cheek for purposes of gathering DNA. Your DNA, and keeping that, God knows where, in a database, you know.
Now, as if getting pulled over wasn't annoying enough.
If that, yeah, right. You know, I got pulled over the other day, and I don't, you know, hey, that's fine. Citizen, perform your role, and if you step out of line, we're gonna whack you for it, you know, over the head with a God knows what. But the point is that, you know, and I've talked about this on the program just as well, I love it how I was a victim of a hit-and-run accident the other day. Actually, it was almost a month ago. When I contacted Highway Patrol and reported the incident, they yelled at me. And the reason why was because, apparently, they were upset with me because I didn't stay at the scene. I pursued the individual who had hit me. And I said, with all due respect, officer, had I not pursued this individual, I wouldn't have been able to get their license tag information, which was corroborated by other witnesses. So the point is that I was able to prove, and I had people who even said that they'd be willing to, you know, sign an affidavit and say, yes, this is what we saw. This was the license plate. We were on the phone with Mike at the time. We saw it. We followed them as well because there were no other witnesses at the scene. And the Highway Patrol says you were supposed to sit there and call 911. And what? Watch while you do nothing? And then what did they do when I called them and supplied them with the name of the intersection? I called and told them, you know, the license tag number, the time, the location.
Sorry.
They didn't even say sorry. They said, well, somebody will call you back, but it's going to be a few minutes. And, of course, I waited all night. I stayed up late, past my bedtime, and never got that phone call. And the next day it didn't arrive, and the next day, and so on and so on. Yeah, you know how it goes. And this is the thing, is that if these officers of the law, and I don't want to mischaracterize anybody out there, because I've got friends who are members of the Asheville Police Department, two of them, who I won't name by name for purposes of privacy, but I've got two. One of them's a really good friend on the APD. I'm not attacking officers of the law. I'm just saying that it seems so often that if you as a citizen, a law-abiding citizen, make a mistake, you're called on the carpet and you have to go pay a fine or a court fee or something like that, or worse, or get points on your license or God knows what. But if you need help, where's the help when you need it? I needed help. No one helped me. Multiple calls to the Highway Patrol. Well, sir, we'll look into that. No, they would never, in one instance, even call back. And yet now, here are Supreme Court, the justices of the United States, who are supposed to be individuals who are perhaps best equipped to make determinations regarding U.S. law and statutes and legislation and whatnot. These individuals have said that it's okay for officers of the law, when they pull an individual over and make an arrest, that they can now take your genetic information using a Q-tip, and that it's okay to collect that and together that, because it's no different, essentially, from, like I was talking with you about earlier, Tyler, it's no different from just taking a thumbprint. You know, last time I had a thumbprint done, they didn't have to put anything in my mouth while I was having the thumbprint taken. And that's, it's just absurd. In fact, it's just a little bit creepy. Why do they need genetic information about Micah Hanks because I was speeding and the officer said that I was a danger to society and decides to take me in? We're going to need some DNA from you, sir. We're going to need to take a blood sample and a stool sample from you while you're here, too. You might as well go ahead and pee in a cup for us as well.
Don't stop till you reach the cavity.
And while you're there, yes, exactly. We're going to find those Illinois caverns. And we're, anyway.
To me, this is unbelievable. And
yeah, it is.
It's not the police officers or individuals, it's the bureaucracy. I mean, the
absolutely
police are not the ones like, hey, let's go swab this dude's mouth.
The Supreme Court justices have said it's okay for them to do that.
And wasn't it Scalia that wrote the dissenting opinion?
Probably was. Absolutely. You know, the Roberts Court, and I don't want to politicize it and say right and left or anything like that. I will say this, however. there are two controversial members of the Supreme Court who were appointed only within the last 6 years or so. You know, and again, I'm an independent, but I was skeptical of these individuals because of bias that they were known to have shown, one of them more than the other, especially at the time that that individual was a professor of, I believe it had been a professor of law. Anywho, it's just absolutely terrifying where we appear to be going in this country these days. And yeah, it's disconcerting. I don't think I have to say any more than to say they are going to collect, if you're arrested, before you are put on trial, whether or not there's probable cause, whatever the case may be. It is stated now, according to the Supreme Court, that it is okay for a officer of the law to collect genetic information about you. And if you are not outraged by that, well, I can't tell you that you should be or that you must be, but I'm going to tell you I am, and I think you should be too, because if you value your privacy and your rights, this is not good. And this is not the kind of thing that I think any law-abiding citizen, or anyone else for that matter, would be comfortable with.
Look out, here come eugenics.
Here come a lot of things, anyway. Oh, and yet, with all these things looming on the horizon, here we are at the end of another edition of the Graylian Report. Thank you so much for tuning in and enjoying this program. If you have thoughts or questions, send them along to info@graylianreport.com. I am Micah Hanks, the Mouth of the South, along with Caleb Hanks and Tyler Pittman. And we'll be with you again next week. Same, what is it, Hadle time, same Hadle channel, right?
Unless sure. We get swabbed out.
That's right, exactly. Anyway, I'm Micah Hanks, and on behalf of all of us here at Graylian International, we bid you adieu, my friends, and until next time, stay strange. We'll talk to you again soon.
Listening to the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website graylianreport.com.